This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 60 years ago, this month, American troops sailed into World War II, coming ashore at Casablanca and Algiers to help push the Germans out of North Africa. The American military wasn't ready. Its victory wasn't easy. But 7 months in the North African deserts revealed much about the American character at war. This hour, On Point historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson on the dawn of American superpower. First, today marked day four of street protests against religious rulers in Iran. Thousands of students in Tehran have gathered to denounce the death sentence delivered on a reformist scholar charged with insulting the Prophet Muhammad. The protests mark a new clash between frustrated reformers and the hardline Islamic conservatives still calling the shots in Iran. Earlier, I spoke with Scott Peterson, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him what's behind the boldness of the Iranian students in their protests.
I think this has a lot more to do with the political situation in Iran and the frustration students feel, and that, in fact, the majority of Iranians feel about the slow pace of reforms here. I think that they're using this one case of the academic who's been charged with blasphemy and basically sentenced to death as a touchstone for much broader issues.
The academic, Hashem Agajari, was charged with insulting the Prophet Muhammad for encouraging, as I understand it, listeners at a speech not to blindly follow religious leaders. Is that necessarily tantamount in Iran to insulting the Prophet Muhammad?
Well, I think that his description of people who might follow such religious leaders as monkeys was something that that raised some eyebrows. But more importantly, what the students say and what many Iranians say is that, of course, these were statements that were made during a lecture at a university, and really free speech in this case should apply. Certainly, there have been quite a few arrests and that sort of thing of opponents of the regime, and certainly liberal newspapers have been shut down, and this is kind of along the same vein. But even conservatives who would normally defend such a move are saying that the judicial system in this case has gone too far.
We read that Iranian students in their protests are actually singing the national anthem of Iran from before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. That sounds like a big statement.
It is a big statement, although we shouldn't take these demonstrations too far out of context. They are nowhere near as large as the ones, for example, that took place here in 1999 when there really was a battle on the streets of Tehran. And the other thing, too, is that one thing that's different this time with the demonstrations is that the student demonstrations, as strong as singing such an anthem may be, really pales by comparison to the statements that are being made by establishment figures themselves. Very influential people in the government, including the Speaker of the Parliament and others, have been very, very critical, extremely critical of this judicial decision, and basically are calling for it to be repealed. Some students, in fact, have said that that they can't go any further than the establishment figures, that they've had the rhetorical wind knocked out of them.
We see that the Speaker of the Parliament expressed his, quote, hatred and disgust over the verdict, over the death sentence. And in the past couple of weeks, there have been bills passed in the Parliament which would seem to be parliamentary efforts to rein in the power of the clergy in Iran. What is the state of this battle over reform? Who's up? Who's down? How powerful are the two sides?
Well, this is basically a very powerful step that is being taken by the reformists who are headed by President Khatami. He's the one who has the more than 70% popular vote. He's a very popular figure. But really, the fact that he has been stymied at every turn by the conservatives in very, very deliberate cases, really the kind of things that have really angered people and frustrated people, means that the people's level of dissatisfaction with Khatami himself is quite high. So that's one of the things that we're seeing here. And I think that that one of the reasons that the president has put forward these two bills to curtail the powers of the conservatives is really also a last-ditch effort for him to kind of reclaim some of his own legitimacy and to basically make a historical mark, recognizing that sometimes you just need to push in order to get things changed here.
it seems there may be a counter push as well. The Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei issued a veiled threat on Monday, saying that he might bring out popular forces, I guess a code word for the Revolutionary Guard and hardline militia there, pro-Islamic militia. Are we headed towards some kind of major showdown in the streets of Iran?
I think that there is a major showdown that's coming. I'm not sure that the seed of it is going to be these student rallies. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of factors that will play into this. Certainly the Supreme Leader, as he is called here, made those statements warning that the popular forces might come out. But he also made a warning to the judiciary to take care in the decisions that they make and that they shouldn't go toward provoking the reformists. I think one of the things that the conservatives are very, very afraid of at the moment, they're certainly on the run, but they're also very, very much afraid that people will take to the streets and that if that kind of thing gains momentum, it really could cause a kind of problem. Very few people here are predicting that there will be a repeat of the 1979 Islamic Revolution where students really did take down the Shah of Iran, the pro-U.S. Monarch who was ruling then. But people are really expecting some serious change, and the conservatives are not willing at the moment to let that happen.
Scott Peterson, how does the war fever across the border in Iraq factor into all this? Does it lend strength to conservatives or reformers?
Well, both sides are concerned about what the impact may be. Although, to be honest, I think that what it really does is add a deepening layer of tension onto the already very, very complicated political situation here. In a lot of respects, you know, it's also forcing people to focus their minds on what kind of relations need to be put together with the United States or not. This has been a big issue for the last 23 years, ever since Iranian radical students took over the American embassy here 23 years ago. So basically since then, and that's been a pillar of the regime, has been hatred toward the United States. And yet in Iraq, there's several strategic reasons why Iranian and U.S. interests coincide.
What signals are coming from Tehran about what Iran's position might be if and when the United States goes to war with Iraq?
Iran is definitely not interested in a war taking place in Iraq, but I think that now they are also reconciled to the fact that the United States is probably going to go for it regardless of the kind of international support they have, and so they need to put that into their calculation. So even though they're against it, they want to also make sure that they are playing a role that they will have a not only a stake, but will have a influence over what the post-Saddam Iraq government is going to look like. One of the ways that they're doing that and that they can do that is that they host the main Shia Muslim rebel opposition group here in Tehran. They've got quite a strong military force, somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000 armed people who are able to move into southern Iraq, and they have a lot of influence over the majority of Iraqis who are also Shia Muslim.
What a situation where we have an internal conflict and potentially one right across the border at the same time. Scott Peterson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. I spoke with him earlier today from Tehran. The American Military Cemetery at Carthage, Tunisia, is as simple and stark as the North African desert. 27 acres of white marble tombstones tell the story of the Allied invasion of North Africa in 1942. But it's only part of the story, says our guest tonight. Operation Torch was a turning point in American history, the moment when America first assumed the mantle of world leadership in a time of world crisis. Here, an untested American military first engaged German forces, fumbled, and finally won. The North African campaign illuminated America's cultural and military strengths and weaknesses at war. Now, on the verge of another desert war, we look back on the campaign that made American soldiers of American citizens in World War II. Listeners, does America still go reluctantly to war? And can we remember what it was like not to be a superpower, not to field a professional, all-volunteer military? What character was revealed in the deserts of World War II, North Africa? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Charleston, South Carolina, is Rick Atkinson, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa, 1942 to 1943. Good evening and welcome, Rick Atkinson.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Also from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Hi, Jack.
So, Rick Atkinson, you've delivered a great tome, the first of three, with incredible detail about the fighting in North Africa, the build-up to it, how the United States came to launch its major foray into World War II in North Africa rather than right through the heart of Europe, rather than making a beeline for Berlin. Paint the picture for us in brief compared to what you've delivered here. What were the circumstances that led the United States into World War II through North Africa?
Well, after Pearl Harbor pulled the United States into the war in December of 1941, there was a great debate over where the United States should strike back. Of course, there was an emotional impulse to attack the Japanese because they had attacked us. Mm-hmm. But there was very early on a decision made between President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill that defeating Germany first was a strategic imperative. Germany was clearly the more potent of the Axis powers. If you could beat Germany, you could crush the Axis. And if you decide you're going to strike at Germany, where? And this debate went on for months and months through 1942. The strategic impulse of the American high command was really to go for the jugular, to cross English Channel, head straight for Berlin, and crush Hitler in his lair.
And as you point out, this had been the time-honored American strategy, which is go straight for your primary target. But you say that President Roosevelt made the most profound American strategic decision of the European war in direct contravention of his generals.
That's true. In fact, virtually all of the American high command, George Marshall, the chief of staff of the army, and almost everyone else believed that this direct head-to-Berlin approach was the way to do it. Churchill persuaded Roosevelt, contrary to the advice of the high command, that the Germans were too strong in Europe. The British had been kicked out of the continent, including at Dunkirk. They recognized how potent the German Wehrmacht was. And Churchill argued that it was better to strike initially at the periphery. This would allow the green American army with its green commanders to be blooded, basically. It would allow the Allies to reclaim the Mediterranean, which was important strategically. And so in late July of 1942, President Roosevelt told General Marshall and the others in the American Brain Trust, we're going to Africa, and that's what we did. November 8th, 1942, we, with the British, invaded North Africa in Morocco and Algeria, 60 years ago, last Friday, in fact. And that's where we started in the redemption of Europe, really. It was the beginning of the liberation of the continent.
The background to this is important to remember. World War II, you point out, had started already in 1939 for many of its actors, not the United States. The war lasted for more than 2,000 days. It claimed an average of 27,600 lives every day for those 2,174 days of the war. But when it began, the United States, you point out, had the 17th largest army in the world. In size and combat power, it ranked behind the military of Romania.
Yes, that perennial powerhouse, Romania. The United States, when the war began on September 1st, 1939, with the German invasion of Poland, was really woefully unprepared. The military had been allowed, after World War I, to sink into a kind of torpor. The army was much, much smaller than the army would need to be in World War II. It was poorly equipped. And so there was a great deal of work to be done between September of 1939 and this first entry of the American army in a major way into the war in November 1942.
Jack Beatty, it's hard to throw our minds back at this point to a time when the United States military ranked in size and power behind that of Romania and when it was a true citizen army.
It is. We have a professional army today. That's one of the salient differences. And I think another is just the psychology, the mentality of the men then. That historical moment was one of peace. I mean, Americans assumed that peace was their normal state. The 18 months of belligerency in World War I had left a sour taste. The intelligentsia was strongly pacifist. The ethnic groups in the country wanted no part of a war that involved the British Empire. And, of course, ever since 1945, our psychology has been just the opposite. War is almost part of what we are and do. Very big difference.
We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Rick Atkinson about his new book, An Army at Dawn. It describes the campaign of the Allies in North Africa to eject the Nazi German forces. You can join the conversation. Is there a consistent character to the American military at war over time and between wars? Can we imagine, after 50 years of superpower, what it was like to be tentatively emerging as top dog? And is the citizen soldier fighting force a relevant model today in the era of the professional army when we look perhaps at a new war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Operation Torch and the Allied World War II invasion of North Africa. Operation Torch forged some of America's great battle captains. Among them was Dwight D. Eisenhower. Here's a clip of Eisenhower speaking from Algiers in 1943 about the importance of support from the home front.
First, let me say that it would be difficult to exaggerate the influence of our successful war loan drives on the men and women under my command. This is a hard war, a bitter, bloody war. Those who are where the guns are firing and the bombs dropping, tough, vicious, treacherous enemy. Make no mistake, it will be a long, long way to final victory, and the road will continue to be rough. Our men know it. They are ready for it. But they want to be always sure, above all else, that the home front stands firmly behind them. They want to know that the folks at home keenly realize that we are all in this together, fighting for our right to lead a free existence.
That was Dwight D. Eisenhower, recorded in Algiers on October 23, 1943, 2 months before he was named Supreme Commander of the Allied Expeditionary Forces. He led the D-Day invasion the following June. We're talking tonight about the Allies' World War II North Africa campaign with Rick Atkinson, author of the new book, An Army at Dawn. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. Did you have relatives in the North Africa campaign? And if those forces weren't ready for war, are we ready today? Are we always war ready now? And I guess also, how did half a century of war and Cold War, how has that all that changed America's attitude toward war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rick Atkinson, we want to hear about this campaign and how it went, how the Greatest Generation did in their first inning out. But before we get into all that, what's your view as someone who's now waded in at least up to your hips and maybe deeper into World War II? Are there abiding characteristics of America at war, of the American military, the American people and culture that should inform our view of all American wars? Or is each one different in its own way?
Oh, I think there's some salient traits that you can find. I think that one of the interesting things about World War II that has bearing today, for example, is Eisenhower's recognition, and we just heard from Eisenhower, that the global war that World War II quickly became was the kind of war where really the best coalition wins, the best team wins. Eisenhower saw this early on in his career, and I think it's important to remember that Eisenhower had never commanded a platoon in combat until he arrives in North Africa, and he abruptly has an army to command and then an army group.
But even that insight would be under some question today when there are many people who are celebrating United States hyperpower and saying we're beyond needing coalitions.
Yeah, but I think you need to remember that in our history, the United States has really only fought two global wars. The first was World War II, and the second, although it's obviously of a much different intensity, is the war we're in now. President Bush has repeatedly stressed how there's no neutral ground in this war. It's really another six-continent war. And I think that even when you're a superpower among all superpowers, that you can't do it alone. And certainly Eisenhower recognized that in World War II early on. And it was really his great gift to the coalition of World War II, and in some extent, the great gift that he left to us today was a belief that trying to wage war with allies, doing what you can, was paramount.
Jack Beatty, Rick Atkinson paints a vivid picture of how the White House was hunkered down for war as they considered going into North Africa. The mansion was battened down for combat. He said they had blackout curtains draped over the windows, skylights painted black. Every room in the old tinderbox, as he calls it, was equipped with a bucket of sand and a shovel, along with folded gas masks. The terror threat today, what was something that they clearly understood or were prepared for in the guise of war then?
Yes, they were. And then, as now, or just to go back a week, there was a president who was eager for war before an election and was sort of trying to use it that way. The president said to General Marshall, please make it before Election Day. It happened the next day, unfortunately, and the Democrats were severely drubbed in that election. You know, I just want to go back to this question of coalition warfare that Rick was talking about. Yes, that was our strength, but of course, as he no doubt points out in his book, it was also a constraint on our action. The key player in some ways in the North Africa campaign was Joseph Stalin, who was demanding that we do something on the Western Front. And the British were unwilling to do the cross-channel invasion. And the next best thing seemed to be South Africa. I mean, it seemed to be
North Africa.
Yeah. And but we were acting partly out of alliance imperatives that we did not share.
We had to jump in somewhere. Rick Atkinson, paint a picture, and we don't have time to do it anything like justice, but give us a sense of how this campaign went. You say there was a lot of green soldiery at the outset of this campaign. How did it go? What lessons were learned?
Well, I think most Americans don't realize that our first adversary when we began the liberation of Europe was our oldest friend. It was the French, the Vichy French. They still controlled North Africa under the deal with the devil that Hitler had forged when he invaded France in the summer of 1940. And so when we landed in Algeria and Morocco, the question was whether or not the French would fire on Americans.
And why did they?
They did, in fact, because they had vowed that they would support the Vichy regime of Marshal Pétain, who was the Vichy leader. And they did it half-heartedly in the army. They did it with great vigor in the navy. There was a ferocious battle against the French navy, the battle at Casablanca on November 8th and 9th of 1942 was one of the great naval battles of the Atlantic. The French were undermanned, under-equipped. After 3 days, they basically lay down their arms. There was an armistice forged. Then the trick was to get to Tunisia, to swing to the east, because if you control Tunisia, you control the Mediterranean.
And it would be the great jumping-off point for Sicily and the planned campaign up through Italy.
It wasn't clear at that point exactly what they were going to do, but certainly it was a way to stab into what Churchill called the soft underbelly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a great underappreciation of exactly how agile the Germans were. We landed on November 8th, 1942. The Germans began to move in force on November 9th, a day later. And
that's
these weren't just dregs that the Germans were sending there. There were many soldiers who had seen experience on the Russian front, 10th Panzer Division, very ferocious unit. And so the American and British forces got within sight of the minarets of Tunis, and they were stopped cold. And basically what you had for the next 5 months was something that was not altogether different from the trench warfare of World War One,
which is not a pretty picture, and which helped leave that 27 acres of American dead in Carthage, Tunisia.
There were 400,000 casualties in the North African campaign, killed, wounded, captured, and missing.
Among all allies and Axis power.
That's exactly right. It was a much more intense, much bloodier campaign than most people remember today. And the greatest defeat in the American Army's history in World War II occurred there at Kasserine Pass, where Rommel drove the American Army back 85 miles, farther than at the Bulge in the Ardennes 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a campaign that was really full of heartache, death, destruction, but of great growth for the American Army.
Rick Atkinson, describe that terrible defeat in the Kasserine Pass to give us a sense of what war was like then. It wasn't stealth bombers and Kevlar and smart bombs. What was the American advance? What did it look like on the ground? And what did the German pushback look like?
Well, it was very primitive combat in certain ways. It was also the first real test between American tank forces and German tank forces. Rommel, who had been defeated at El Alamein in October and November of 1942, had retreated all the way across North Africa. He closed in southern Tunisia. He recognized that if he could surprise the Americans who were gathering there, that he could potentially steal a victory from the jaws of defeat for the Axis. On Valentine's Day morning, February 14th, 1943, he struck at a place called Sidi Bouzid, and quickly the Americans were reeling. Most people think of North Africa as being palm trees and desert and Hedy Lamarr. In fact, in February, it's more like northern Italy.
That terrain is cold.
The terrain is rugged. It's very cold. The conditions are extremely harsh. Being an infantryman in the winter of 42-43 was a very, very hard life.
So this was thousands of American infantrymen surrounded by tanks and German tanks coming at them.
Yes, and the American casualties exceeded 6,000. Rommel basically cut the Americans off. He drove them back into the mountain range in the on the Algerian border through a terrain feature known as Kasserine Pass, and then he ran out of steam. He just didn't have the power to complete the encirclement that he envisioned, and he retreated back across the breadth of Tunisia, and basically it was a tactical defeat of the first order for the Americans, but not what we would call a strategic defeat. They regrouped rather quickly. Patton was brought in to take command. The previous commander, Lloyd Friedendahl, was sent home. Patton emerges really for the first time on the global stage. And the Americans kind of picked themselves up, pulled themselves up by the bootstraps, and went on with it. And 3 months later, the Germans and the Italians are surrounded. The bridgehead is shrunk to a very small holding pen, really. Hitler made the strategic decision not to evacuate his forces, and what you have in the middle of May 1943 is 250,000 German and Italian troops surrendering in a defeat that is almost as catastrophic as Stalingrad had been for the Germans 3 months earlier.
And finally, a real victory, but as you point out, it wasn't all perfect efficiency along the way. Rick Atkinson, give us a profile of the American trooper circa 1942-1943 in North Africa as compared to today.
Well, I think you have to remember, of course, that a large portion of the American Army in 1942 and 43 are draftees. There are four American divisions fighting in Tunisia as the campaign comes to an end. One of them, the 34th Infantry Division, was the Iowa National Guard, a regiment thrown in from Minnesota. These are really citizen soldiers in a fundamental way. They are led in some cases by regular officers, West Pointers in some cases. But that's a very small percentage of the whole army. So there's a lot of learning by doing.
I want to just cite something that you note here. The conscript, the draftee had to stand at least 5 feet tall at that time and weigh 105 pounds, have 12 or more natural teeth out of the 32, and be free of flat feet, venereal disease, and hernias. And you say that more than 40 of every 100 men, according to this screen, were rejected, a grim testament to the toll taken on the nation's health by the Great Depression.
Yeah, it's pretty astonishing exactly how poor American youth were in terms of their physical fitness.
They weren't asking much, 12 teeth.
12 teeth, and, you know, it got to the point where the joke was that they were no longer examining eyes, they were just counting them.
Rick Atkinson, I want to welcome into our conversation a gentleman who was a veteran of the campaign you've written about in such detail. Raymond Wrightsey Sr. joins us from Buxton, Maine. He was a former Army artilleryman and World War II veteran. He fought in the North Africa campaign and was taken prisoner by the Germans. He was in a German POW camp for 26 months. Good evening and welcome, Raymond Wrightsey Sr.
Well, thank you, sir.
Mr. Wrightsey, thank you for joining us. Where did you serve in the North Africa campaign?
I landed in the Tunisian area. I was with the Second Army. Friedenau was our general. In fact, it was supposed to have been a secret, and Roosevelt gave it away and all the lights come on before we landed.
What were the spirits of the troops, if you think back to that long-ago time, Raymond Wrightsey? When you went into North Africa, did you feel confident that you would kick the Germans out quickly or something else?
No, I figured we would. In fact, I thought the spirits was high. And actually, I was put in as a lineman, and they give me a rifle. I enlisted myself in June of 40, so.
How old were you at that time, Mr. Retzel?
I was 19 when I enlisted.
So about 21 when you went to North Africa.
Right. Now, they shipped me from the States to England, and mm-hmm. I had to train in Tidworth. Mm-hmm. And nights and weekends, I had to pull military police duty.
When you got to North Africa, did you have the feeling that you and your fellow soldiers were well-trained, well-equipped, and ready for the battle?
I thought we were, but we wasn't. And we was ill-equipped. Our tanks, the Germans were blowing our tanks up like tissue paper. The shells from our tanks were bouncing right off in theirs. And some of the fellows didn't even have ammunition for their rifles.
How were you ultimately captured by the Germans, Mr. Reitze?
The day I was captured was on the 14th of February. We landed on the beaches on November the 8th of 42.
Mm-hmm.
February the 14th. I never see so many tanks in my life. And they were German tanks. And it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I've never forget it. I'll never will. But that day then, I got it right in front of me.
Where exactly were you? How exactly did they take you prisoner?
Well, they captured me in the vicinity of Kasserine Pass when they captured us. In fact, I was with 2 Corps, and of 30,000 Americans engaged under 2 Corps,
mm-hmm.
nearly 1 in 4 were casualties. An estimated 300 were killed, 3,000 wounded, and 3,000 missing or captured.
Rick Atkinson, join us here. Raymond Reitze Sr. says that they thought they were going well prepared to war, but it turns out they weren't.
Yeah, I think Mr. Reitze's experience is pretty typical. There was a widespread belief by soldiers who were being sent into North Africa that, in fact, all the training that they had gone through in the States and in many cases in Britain before they sailed in these secret convoys to Algeria and Morocco had prepared them, that they were, in fact, ready to take on the fearsome Wehrmacht. And what they found in many cases was that they really were not prepared, and he's absolutely right that much of the equipment that they had was inferior to the Germans, particularly our armor. We found early on in Tunisia that the American tanks were really quite secondary to the German tanks. And you heard him say he was captured on February 14th. That was the beginning of the great offensive that became known as the Battle of Kasserine Pass.
Mm-hmm.
Part of this lack of preparation of American soldiers was the fact that they were caught by surprise. And that wasn't the fault of soldiers like Mr. Reitze, but it was the fault of their officers, who in many cases were almost as green as the ordinary GI.
Raymond Reitze, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. It's been an honor talking with you, and thanks for sharing your memories of the North Africa campaign.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought this up about the North African campaign, because it bothers me. Because I didn't, it's always heard about Normandy or Italy, and I didn't feel it was right for the fellows that never come home from North Africa.
And there were a lot of them. Rick Atkinson is doing a lot to make sure that memory stays alive. Raymond Reitze, thank you so much for joining us. We're talking tonight about the Allies' World War II North Africa campaign. Is there a consistent character to the American military at war over time between wars? Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Away out Texas way, from the top of Maine to the...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Allies' World War II North Africa campaign, and perhaps about the American character at war as well. Is there a consistent character to the American military at war? Can we imagine, after 50 years of superpower, what it was like to be tentatively emerging as top dog? And how has half a century of war and Cold War changed America's attitude toward war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Atkinson. He's out with a new book, the first of a trilogy. The title is An Army at Dawn. And the dawn he's talking about is the dawn of American forces as a great power to be contended with in this world, in that war. Jack Beatty, it really is hard to look back from this vantage when we have invisible airplanes and weapons with computers in their nose and goggles that help see through everything, at what it must have been like to look out on a troubled world from American shores and not to feel like a hyperpower.
Yes, and to think that those shores, that the oceans that they demarcated were in fact our defense. That was certainly part of the American mentality. And one, I think, huge difference between the way the soldiers looked at it then and now is that the Army, and Rick hit on this, reflected the country then. It did not, as today's Army does, reflect really a portion of the country, heavily weighted toward minorities and toward, Colin Powell calls the sons and daughters of Kmart parents. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the questions for this country in this world is how much can we demand of Kmart parents that the rest of us aren't paying?
Rick Atkinson, what about it? Is it right to look out at the U.S. military with anything like the eyes Americans looked upon their own military half a century ago today, when it's all volunteer, when it's professional, when it is not anything like a cross-section of the country?
Well, I think the degree of emotional investment that the country has today is certainly different than it was in 1942, 1943, when the campaign in North Africa was beginning. You know, the American Army in 43 was growing to 8 million. It was a rare family that did not have a son serving in some capacity, either in uniform in the armed services or somehow in the national defense construct. And today, it's quite the opposite. It's quite rare to find a family that has a son or daughter that's in the service. You know, you find an entire generation. I'm 49 years old, and I know very few people my age or younger who've actually served in the military, who have the experience that a generation older than I am almost collectively have.
Rick, is that because of the crowd you run with and the place you live? I mean, surely there are neighborhoods when this, at least being in the National Guard, is not at all uncommon.
Yeah, sure. It's to some extent the crowd I run with and where I live, I think. But I also think that when you've got an army that is, you know, less than one-tenth the size that it was in World War II, and it's an army that's all volunteer.
And a country much larger.
The country is twice the size, so that it attracts a different clientele, really, and it is a clientele because the army is essentially selling itself now. It's selling itself as a social elevator, among other things.
And a career.
There's nothing wrong with that. It's what we've decided, the body politic has decided to do in the 21st century. It's just a different landscape.
Rick Atkinson, stand by. We have callers who want to join us. Angelo's on the line. Welcome, Angelo. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening. I was in the invasion of Casablanca.
You were?
Yes.
In 42?
In 42, I landed the troops on the beachhead.
What service? You were in the Navy then, Angelo.
I was an amphibious. And
How did it look to you? Taking them ashore. Were we ready?
No, we were not ready. Thank God that when we landed, we had very little resistance on the beachhead. But the troops were really green. Didn't know what to do. Matter of fact, thank God that we landed all troops from all three transports on the beach.
Otherwise,
they would have been more dead.
What was the mood among your colleagues there, Angelo, as you saw that campaign unfold? Did you feel a confidence that America would eventually prevail or something else?
Well, I felt confidence in myself that we would prevail because everybody was eager to get into the fight. But they were green. We were all green, actually.
And did they feel, I don't know, betrayed that they weren't better prepared, or was this just accepted as the way it was?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they realized what they were getting involved in.
Mm-hmm. Angelo, when you look out at what we see of the U.S. military today, fighting in Afghanistan, the preparation for a potential war in Iraq, does this look like the same military at all to you?
Oh, no, it's entirely different. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, no, it's entirely different. I think they have better training today. You're more apt to do what you're supposed to do. No, period. I don't think that the men of my era could have fought in the war today in a modern war.
And your North Africa experience, you put the troops ashore at Casablanca, then what? Did you turn around and go home, or were you there for the duration?
We never got a chance to unload the transports with the equipment. All three transports were sunk.
That's not a good start.
We were very fortunate to land all the troops from all three transports on the beachhead.
Right.
Otherwise, there would have been more killed.
But the equipment didn't make it. Angela, thanks.
The equipment never made it on shore.
Yeah.
We were supposed to go and unload them. We never made it.
Angela, thanks so much for your call. Rick Atkinson, compare the training of that time and the training of today. Is this just a different level? Do we have a much more completely well-versed military, or is there still this element of unknown when you go into a military campaign?
Well, I think that's something that people should always remember, that there's an element of unknown, that when you pull the stopper out of the bottle, you never know quite what's going to come out when you're talking about war. And that's as true today as it was in 1942. Certainly the training methods are different. There's a much higher level of sophistication. The technology that's available to today's military is several generations removed from that 1942 and 43. So it's a different kind of warfare, but there are certain fundamentals about war in general, certain principles. And one of those principles is that it never goes as you expect it's going to go. Mm. Angelo's description of arriving in North Africa, thinking they were prepared and then not being prepared, is something that could happen today. We find it in Somalia, for example, in 1993. That was a tremendously well-trained group of Rangers and Delta soldiers.
And still it didn't work right.
It didn't work right, and that sometimes happens in war. It frequently happens in war.
Fred is on the line. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a different angle to all this. I'm concerned myself that we are beginning, as a nation, we're becoming like we're glorifying armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are looking at this as like the greatest thing going on for us right now.
Mm-hmm.
This is a country that was known for human rights, the Constitution, education, invention. When we were in World War II, that's what we were, a nice country who came in to help.
Mm-hmm.
But for the last 55 years, we are, a lot of people in the world think that we are the threat now, that we are beginning to be a threat to world peace.
Fred, we've got your point. I want to get it to Rick Atkinson. Our time is running down. What about it, Rick? Do we now over-glamorize? Do we over-glorify war? Is there a distinct shift? Do you feel the same way that Fred does?
Well, I don't think anybody can read my book, An Army at Dawn, and come away thinking that I've glorified it. I certainly don't believe that. You know, war is a glorious enterprise, and I think that it's important to remember that when the balloon goes up and the dogs of war are unleashed, that young men die. And in the case of World War II, they died by the hundreds of thousands. And certainly, you know, I think that anybody who believes that it's a glorious venture is living in the wrong century. So, you know, his point is well taken. I write about war not because I think it's glorious. I write about war because it is a tremendous refractor of character. You see the men for good and ill.
You see the brave and the virtuous, but also the cowardly, venal, and foolish.
You know, there's a feeling about World War II veterans to some extent today that all the men were valiant and all the women were virtuous. And I'm here to tell you it's not true. They're much more interesting than that. They have feet of clay, just like the rest of us.
Just like all the rest of us. Rick Atkinson, we are out of time. We look forward to the rest of your trilogy, and thanks for digging in so much fascinating detail. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Tom, thank you for having me.
Rick Atkinson is Pulitzer Prize winner and author of the new book, An Army at Dawn First, in a trilogy on World War II. Jack Beatty, there's the beginning of a long war that took all those lives. We were talking about 27,600 per day for more than 2,000 days.
Well, the greatest disaster in human history.
There it was. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, veterans volunteer to remember their own. This is On Point. U.S. veterans die each day in the United States, with World War II-era veterans accounting for more than half of that number. At a minimum, deceased veterans are entitled to the playing of taps and the presentation of a flag to the next of kin at their funeral. But with so many funerals each day, members of the military are not always available to perform these rituals, so some veterans groups are pitching in. At 11 national cemeteries, including Saratoga in upstate New York, a volunteer honor guard of veterans attends every military funeral. The 100 or so honor guard members in Saratoga, average age 65, split into squads of six that handle as many as seven funerals a day. In this radio diary, William Potts, the commander of the Saratoga National Honor Guard Association, explains why he and his colleagues volunteer to attend 1,000 funerals per year.
We form in the sidewalk and we escort the casket from the hearse to the building. And then at the conclusion of the religious portion or anything that the family intends to do, then we fire a three-round volley, play taps, fold, and present the flag to the next of kin. And in some cases, we remain to the rear of the building as a quiet honor guard back there until the people leave the shelter area and the casket is moved to the back of the building by the cemetery personnel to be taken to the gravesite. The toughest part is on the people that are in the shelter area itself that are doing the flag fall and the flag presentation, because you're closest to the next of kin, which you're involving in the of the emotions of the people. Sometimes it has an effect on you, depending on the severity of the emotions of the people. Taps and the presentation of the flag usually brings on the tears. It affects you, but it's a necessity that you do. It's something that's owed to the veterans, and we just feel that it's veterans taking care of veterans. And we accept the emotion part of it, okay? They usually try to keep the ceremony to 20 minutes of ceremony, but sometimes the religious aspect of it, or sometimes the next of kin might want to get up and do some recitations on the individual, and then sometimes it gets longer. And, you know, we're out there in any weather from anywhere from 100 degrees to 10 or 15, 20 below zero, you know. Just stick it out in most cases, but it gets tough. Because, like I said, most of these guys are older. There's everybody's got something wrong with them. A lot of people are on medication. In fact, one case of it was a guy where he had taken a three-hour chemotherapy treatment and came right to the cemetery to be ready to do that, and he was out in the sun a little too long, and we had to have him taken away. But you couldn't get him out of there. You had a tough time getting him out of there. Oh, and then that's how strong that the dedication is to this with the organization. It's a sense of brotherhood. It's a sense of family. Most veterans serve, whether it's peacetime, wartime, whatnot. It's if you've ever been in service, you understand the family aspect of it, okay? Everybody seems to be going through the same trauma at the same time, and there's a bonding there. And it's something that it never goes away. The older you get, the stronger it gets. And it's that you never want to see one of your own be deprived of the military honors that's coming to him, be deprived of this. And that's the basic reason why most of these guys are here.
William Potts lives in Latham, New York. In 1993, he retired after 39 years of service in the Army and National Guard. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.